So I have a few CDs out on the table. You could just take one if you'd like one. I bought them for you. It's our first album that nuns and, you know, I had, there was only one other person that had male and females together in their monastery that happened to have been Bhante Gunaratana in the early years. But in the later years, he stopped ordaining. He was really the one who facilitated women being able to ordain here in the U.S. But as he started getting older, he said he realized that in order for the monastery to continue to serve, you know, in the East, in the West, that he would need the support of the Thai Sangha. And of course, you all know that the Thai Sangha did not want to acknowledge bhikkhunis. So from 2004, I think, to maybe 2010, I would go to Thailand and ordain bhikkhunis, you know. So there was this great letter writing campaign, they had garnered over 250,000 signatures to implore the Thai council to accept women. And I was going to do an ordination of some Thai women in Thailand. Now I'm getting to this for a reason. So you know the difference between understanding things and thinking things in your mind and actually having the fearlessness to carry it out is what I'm talking about. And so, you know, all of the sanghas and the monastic orders and the meditation centers got together and they wrote a letter and signed this petition. And there were 250,000 signatures. And I was sneaking over there to conduct a bhikkhuni ordination. And I can tell it now, couldn't tell it for many, many years for other people's safety. But Princess Chulaporn would support, you know, the advancement. She supported the advancement of women. So in a way that she could help without going against the law, she did help. And that was mostly like hiding us so that we could, you know, like be safe. While we did the ordinations and we had a few male monks there to support the female monks. They would just hold a fan in front of their face, you know, and give a cockeyed signature, witness signature. But we needed to record it for posterity's sake and so that nobody could come along later and say that it didn't happen, you know. And at the same time, to protect those monks that did come forward to support us. And sometimes you just have to have the wisdom to know how to do things and make some compromises. This absolute no compromising thing, it is not a right view. The Buddha says we should never be all in over this versus that, but you have to see this within that in all things. And as your wisdom develops, you know how to. He said, it's like walking on a tightrope. And he said, you can't like just walk straight across a tightrope. He said, it takes a little bending here and a little bending there, you know, along with the circumstances of each step to know how to execute something. And so they heard I was going over to do some ordination. They want me to take the letters, you know, and present the letters while I'm over. No, I'm not taking those letters. You know, I'm not taking any letters asking them to allow something. I'm going over there and I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to, you know, like brag about it. I could talk about it now 20 years later. I'm not going to brag about it. I'm not going to go and demanding any rights. I'm just going to do quietly what has to be done. At some point in time, they could no longer say that there weren't any bhikkhunis in Thailand because they were like all over the place, you know. And I did about 50 nuns, and then my 50 nuns have 50 nuns. I mean, like, they're just like all like bunny rabbits. They're like all over the place, all over the place. And so sometimes we can do something, and just the skillfulness and the fearlessness of doing it. But everything requires a certain kind of you have to be selfless in your actions so that everyone is considered. We had to keep the princess, you know, safe. We had to keep her hands out of it. So we always combined it with some other activity that she could legitimately, you know, be a part of, and in that way assist us in coming. There were others that we needed to protect because they live there. I'm just flying in, doing the ordination, and flying out, you know, until it got to the place that I couldn't fly in anymore because they knew who I was. And so that ended for me. But by that time, the work had been done. There's another nun, she lives there. She couldn't take any part of it, but she was actually the one, you know, who arranged it all, who arranged for me to come, who asked me to do this, and she was willing to live there, although they were putting, she's Caucasian, and so they would put flyers under the gate of the nunnery of a decapitated white woman and say, this is what's going to happen to you. You know, I mean, they would go by and shoot into the nunnery, into the sanctuary area, and she would be in there meditating, and she said, I could not move, because if I move, you know, the thing is to cut off the head, and, you know, the body dies. So she said, I could not move for the sake of the bhikkhunis. I had to stay steadfast and still. And she did. And she didn't. By some means of great blessings, she survived. You know, they were never able to take her life. But she did suffer to do this, you know. And so a lot of the things that we do and the offerings that we offer up are for the perfected bodhisattvas and also for the imperfect bodhisattvas, you see, because there are different stages of bodhisattva-dom, I guess you could say, you know, for one who is just beginning to walk in this way, that they see others equal with themselves, and they still have defilements. We still have defilements that we're working on. And thinking that we cannot be bodhisattvas, he said, but if that's your desire, you have to know that you are, you have to know that you are a bodhisattva. You have to know that where your own mind is. So a lot of this practice, we want all the answers. You know, okay, what page is that on? How do I categorize this thing that's happening? What is the level of that? And so, because that's the way of the world. That's the worldly way of assessing things. You know, but this is something that you come to know for yourself. You come to know your own level. You know where you are in the Dhamma because you live in that territory. In your willing to be truthful with yourself, you know, you come to really know your own mind. Some people don't even know their own mind. They're one way and they think that they're another way. I had a lady in my church, and she was, she was such a busybody. Oh, my goodness. And so one day I just said, okay, this is it. I'm going to give a Dhamma talk. I mean, not a Dhamma talk. I'm going to give a sermon, but it was on being a busybody, right? I was like, this is where I have to go with this now. And so I give this talk, and it was a great talk. You could not miss what being a busybody was, the danger, the damage it caused, the danger to your own progress, everything. I laid it all out full of examples, because I used to have a million stories back then. Oh, now I forget myself. But she comes up after the sermon and says, oh, Pastor, I just love that talk you gave today. And I'm so glad I'm not a busybody. I was like, I threw my hands up and said, that's it. I'm through. But in this practice, you will start to actually see yourself, but not because you're also cultivating compassion, right? You cultivate compassion for all beings. Well, you're included in all. So you're cultivating compassion for all beings And you're in the mix. So when you're examining things, you're also developing compassion for yourself. And a lot of us have come from backgrounds, you know, we like to think like if something's wrong in our background, that that's so bad and we're the only ones, you know, nobody else in the world goes through the things that we go through, you know, and we have this attitude that our suffering is so much greater than everybody else's suffering. It's not true. And we compare ourselves to each other to come with our rankings of suffering. And so it helps us overcome that sense that we're not worthy because somebody said we weren't. It helps us to overcome that inferiority complex that we have. And it's so easy to attach to something. I'll tell you how easy it is. Now, I like to talk about this because I like to see people continually come together and work out their issues. And so when in the, I guess that must have been the 80s, maybe the 90s, maybe the 90s, maybe the early 2000s when like we had many allies that came forward to support people of color, and it was the first time, you know, and this was the whole talk of breaking out into POC groups and stuff like that. And I was like, no, I'm against that. I'm against it from the pro side, and I'm against it from the con side. I didn't win. It's okay, but from the pro, the con side is if you think people don't want you to be around them, that you're not good enough, stay right there. That was my con side. Don't go off into a separate group. Stay right there. They just going to have to get used to you. Just going to have to mix. No. And then there was a pro side where people who had been marginalized could hear, could express themselves and really feel connected and part of a group on both sides, that they could speak freely and not wanting to offend, but like, that's just the way I feel about you. You know, that could also be expressed and things could get worked out. So there was a pro and a con, but I felt that it outweighed for us to stay together than for us to break apart into groups. And so I wanted it to stay that way. And it couldn't stay that way because, you know, I was overruled. Everybody thought that this is the, you know, this is the age of people coming out and speaking their truth and so forth. And all I would say is some things take time. Like I said, sometimes there has to be a turning of a generation. Sometimes, you know, I mean, I can't tell these young people anything. I mean, they like are all mixed together. A great majority of them, you know, they're mixed together in race. They're mixed together in gender. They're mixed together in, you know, in rich and poor together. All of these things that some people in my generation and before my generation just couldn't even fathom because that's the way it was. And so sometimes we just have to, you know, one plants, another waters, and another gets the increase. And so this is how one has to think. Otherwise, patience will never take root in them. We can't just be like reading about patience and saying, I'm practicing patience. But we have to actually apply it in the matters that concern our lives. And so it's like, who will go and speak for the Dhamma? Who will go and stand for this? You know, these are the things that we're called to do. And it's not always an easy thing to do because people think you should be doing some other things. But in these kinds of practices, you will wake up from the intellectual notion of things because your fearlessness, he gave the lion's roar when he woke up. And then he no longer feared any man. He could just say the truth of a thing. Whatever happened to him happened. You know, and there were ones who heard that story coming from this one who had stepped away from everything. He renounced his wealth, he renounced his position, and he renounced his status and title, his authoritative title. I don't think he was really a prince and his father a king. I think he was like a chieftain and something else, you know, but that's their story. But he renounced all of that to live this life and cultivate it. And that's what attracted people, not what he said, but what he actually did with his life. So I ask you, what are you doing with your life? And to not despise small beginnings. Everything is precious. Everything. Because everyone is precious. So if we only help one person in this life and do that with our whole heart, you know, that's what has a untold benefit and value. So don't think that because you're doing a little thing that it doesn't matter, because it does matter. And even if you ended up only taking care of you and changing you, you take one little bad seed out of the world. So just think of it in that way. So don't think in terms of large or big actions and small actions. Just think of right action. And after a while, every step you'll take, there will be that question, is this the right action? All day long, you have a constant friend. You won't even have time to get on the internet and to be calling up folks, because you always have like this watcher that you have established asking you to think about a thing and judge it before you do it. Think about a thing and judge it while you're doing it. Or saying it, and think about it and judge it after you have it. Not with the heavy hand judgment, but with that kind of discrimination that allows you to look at it and say, is what I'm going to do really beneficial and useful? And while I'm doing it, is it still, you know, how you start maybe having a conversation with somebody, and the conversation starts out all right, and then somebody else comes up in the conversation, and you know that person too, and you all are just kind of talking about something, and before you know it, your mind goes back to, yeah, and I remember when she said such and such about me, or she did thus and so, and before you know it, something has crept into the conversation, like y'all still just having a conversation, but underneath, something's creeping in there that is not no longer beneficial, no longer useful, no longer even germane. You're just like getting a dig in right now. I mean, I used to be like that myself, you know. And one day I was, I'm practicing. Practicing is judging in the moment my thoughts, my speech, my action as I'm executing, right? And I'm sitting here at the water fountain because I always went to the water fountain. The reason you go to the water fountain is because whoever's not at the water fountain, that's who's going to be talked about. You know, so when I see people gathering for a break, I would go too, because it ain't going to be me. But then one day, I'm being all self-righteous, you know, because I get all this stuff. I had the Dharma in me, right? So I get up there, and we're doing something, and a person came through, and I'm still working on that. I'm still working on, you know, my improving my attitude towards her. And I wasn't like fully there yet. So they said something up, and I got incensed about it because she's doing something to somebody else that she did to me too, you know. So I'm bringing this forth as a warning, you know, and I'm telling this story, but I really wasn't doing it as a warning. I was talking about her, you know. So right there, the conviction hit me that I was going against my precept and going against my vow. She has not taken that precept and vow, so she could do whatever she wants, but I have taken a precept and a vow. And so it hit me that I'm breaking my vow. And I just turned to everybody at the water, and this is how I broke free of that. I said, okay, I'm going back to my cubicle now because I'm gossiping. And I turned around and I walked away. And I never went to the water fountain again during the unofficial breaks, because that's how I broke that thing. So you have to look and come up with your own remedy for your own things. But if you find a teacher that points out your faults, I tell you, stay with that teacher, because that's where your liberation and your freedom is gonna come, because they're gonna help you at the very thing you said you wanted to happen. Okay, so this was a very long mandala offering. I and other living beings offer all of our physical actions, speech, and thoughts, wealth, good fortune in our past, present, and future lifetimes, and the wonderful treasures to the Master Yidam and the three jewels. Om Savatadataka, Yidam Guru Ratnam, Mayad Dayamis. Okay, so we're getting ready to go back into the meditation. And the reason why I want to take you back into it now is to show you that it's like the sleepiness. All of that we have control over. This is the disciplines that we work at. And so we're going to go into, I know after you eat, you get tired. And I'm going to show you that about finding the state and knowing where that state is and going back to that state and dropping in again and again and again, no matter whether you were asleep just before, or no matter whether you were tired and racing just before, or no matter what occurred the minute before, the minute you direct your attention, you are able to drop back into that state, and you start to know the power of a vow. Did I give you? But wait a minute. Before that one, we had to do the Vajrasattva. And yeah, it's on there. Because we'll do that as the ending to the mandala offering.
Yes, that's the unincluded.
No, that's the next one. I just want to chant, and it's and then unimpeded ease. So that's the ending of the offering.
No, it's not the mic. It's
it's you.
Yeah, it doesn't sound. So sounded.
Okay, so I'll do the Chinese version. I like the Sanskrit version. Okay. May I be of use, may I be of benefit. That is the old one. Because it doesn't have the bass. Compassionate action has no limit. Like the smoke dancing in the wind. Not caught or bound by anything. Stillness of peace. I wish in my heart a state of unimpeded ease. I wish in my heart a state of unimpeded ease. Untie my knot from selfish wants,
untie my knots of hurtful thoughts. May it be of use, may it be of benefit. May I be of you. Compassionate action has no limit, like the smoke dancing in the wind. Not caught or bound by anything. I wish your mind's a state of unappealing. I wish your mind's a state of unappealing. Like the smoke dancing in the wind. Not caught or bound by I wish your mind's a state of unimpeded ease. I wish your mind's a state of unimpeded ease. My 26-year-old nun wrote that song when I taught her how to meditate, and that was her. She wished a mind's a state of unimpeded ease, like the smoke dancing in the wind, not caught or bound by anything, freely moving in the stillness of peace. I wish a mind's a state of unimpeded. Then I saw that head toss, ease. So that's what I'm trying to help you establish and find, that estate of unimpeded ease. And it's where I'll tell you, it's where the joy comes from. And he talks about the sukha and the piti. It is a state that one is in. They don't need something to make them happy. They don't need something to give them a sense of joy. They don't, you know, it's ever churning and abiding kind of bliss that is in you. And it rises up and helps you to cope with the vicissitudes of life. So there's this little time you have to go through to train yourself to know where it is. And then anytime you want, the Buddha said, whether you're sitting, standing, walking, lying down, you know, he wasn't like creating a little thing where we are walking, you know. That's like a robotic outer thing. But he's talking about no matter what state you find yourself, what you're doing, you can be in this state of unimpeded ease. That's the real thing. Not our walking meditation. It's the real thing, not our sitting meditation where we're training ourselves, but having well trained ourselves, then we become it and we're moving in it all the time. And that's the real deal. Okay, so this is just practice. This is just fake right now, okay? This is fake. We're just kind of practicing it. But, you know, and they don't say that practice makes perfect, or maybe they do, but, you know, it's perfect practice that makes perfect. You know, so we're moving towards perfect practice. And nobody judges that by you. You'll know when you're in that state. I know when I'm in it. You know, you'll know sometimes it's like more decorum, Panavati. More, you know, I move my hands. I said, don't move your hands. We're trained to not move. So we give off this aura of being so peaceful. You know, we give off this, you know, I tell you, there is a marvelousness in it. There is a joy in it. And it is contagious, and it's powerful to the uprooting of strongholds in other people's lives. That's why we have to have it, you know. We have to have it so that we can help uproot. We can be a true friend, a true Dharma friend uproots, you know, the hardship, the feeling of hardship in people's lives. So whatever I have, I freely give. I share that, whatever I honestly have, you know. Okay, so now it's time to find yours. And so we can go back for a second time. I tell you, when you get home tonight, you can't always do it, you know, like when you're out. Sometimes when I'm at somebody else's place, I don't want them to think I'm weird. So like I may not cover my head, but I sure do miss it, because it's almost like a shield. They say, oh, we like to be together with everybody, because, you know, more people pump up the energy. That depends on what kind of energy you got. You know, I don't want to have to spend my whole meditation period trying to tamp down, out, pushing away your energy. You know, so I like to meditate by myself. You know, and I know whatever's there, I conjured it up. I brought that up, whatever's there. But a lot of people like to come together because they feel more supported, you know, when we come together and we meditate. But generally when I go out to a place, unless I'm specifically teaching on meditation, we don't meditate. I got what, one day with you, what, 2 hours with you? We're going to talk Dharma. You go home and unpack it and meditate by yourself. And that's, but today we're meditating together because we want to get the hang of this over this weekend. Okay. All right. So, let's go kind of through the steps. I admit that there's an advantage if you're already a happy one. You know, that's what they call the Buddha's disciples, the happy ones. Did you know that? I mean, I think they got a little bit overboard, or people misunderstood them. They were too happy to be spiritual people, you know. And so he had to start clamping them down because people would misunderstand. And then they wouldn't be open to the message, you know. But I know he did that because he started saying things like, don't touch each other. You know, you couldn't touch each other in public. So I imagine they were like laughing. Sometimes they were like just in having a great camaraderie. He said, to the worldly people, you know, that doesn't look good, you know, so they don't know this joy that you have, you know, so like no touching. And then he'd come up, and then it would be another thing and another thing and another thing. And before you knew it, we had 300, the women had 300 and some rules, because we need a lot more than the men. And they had 200 and some rules. And you could take anywhere from 5 to the 300, however many you want. The thing is, when you become a monastic, you don't even know. Well, now they got it in books that you can actually get your hands on. But back when I ordained, you didn't even know what all the rules were you were taking. You took 10, and it said, and all the rest. You took 10 and all the rest. They mentioned the main ones, like don't steal, don't kill, don't lie. For us, we have to be celibate. For lay people, you don't. Part of their 10 doesn't include the celibacy vow. You know, so it went for all of those, and then it said in all the rest. And I started reading all the rest, and I started saying, I'm going to be like Ajahn Chah. Because they asked Ajahn Chah, he said, I think men have 200 and something, 258, something like that, in the Theravada. And he said, you keep all 200? He said, I keep one. He said, what? You only keep one rule? He says, I keep rule over my mind. And that's what all of those rules are for. You know, some people need a standard that they can ascribe to help them overcome some behavior that's not befitting for them. You know, so one by one, the rules got in because people did things that destroyed the harmony. You know, a wife would come from a man who had gone into the holy life. She said, you left me without an heir. I'm in a, And they believed back then having a son gave you passageway to heaven, to going to heaven. A daughter, not so much. But having a son was your ticket into heaven. So the women, she said, I don't have a son. So he comes back to help her have a son. I mean, he didn't stay. He just came to help her, you know. And then he went back. And so then they found out, oh, he got his wife pregnant. And so the Buddha laid down a rule. Okay, no going home and visiting with your wife because they want an heir or whatever. Okay, so that's how a rule got into place. So there were no rules in the beginning. But as people committed infractions that destroyed the harmony of the group, they set in some training guidelines. So that's how I hold them. I hold them as training guidelines. Some of those apply to me because I need that kind of training. Some of them don't apply to me because I don't need that particular kind of training. And so I just want you to know how things came about so that you know how to hold them hold them properly. And sometimes you need something until you're trained, but once you are trained and that becomes a part of you, then you learn. It's like learning how to ride a bicycle. You have to have training wheels on, you know. So some of us in here have a trike. We can ride a trike but not a bike. Some of us can almost ride a bike, but we have to have the training wheels to help us like stay up so that we only lean so far to the left or to the right. You know, those training wheels will keep you from, and you can bend it a little bit, but go past here and you're in trouble. So the training wheels help you. But after you get to riding that two-wheeler really well, you know, the training wheels are kind of askew so that it allows for some motion so you can get used to the movement of the bike, right? It's not, doesn't keep you straight like this. It allows you to bend a little bit. So listen to me now, because I'm talking about how you use rules and how you use, you know, precepts and knowing where you are in their usage. So here it is. So you now you can ride really good. You can zip up the hill and zip down the hill. So now you say, now I'm going to start going around the corner. Okay, but I'm going to tell you, on a bike with training wheels, there's no zipping around the corner because the wheels are only this flexible. So when you start trying to go around the corner and you try to zip full speed, you are going to fall over or the bike just can't do it. You have to do like this to get around the corner. So now it's time to take off those training wheels so you can lean into the curve, you see. And so, I mean, this is reality. This is real world stuff. And so is the Dharma. All worldly Dharma is Buddha Dharma. All of the Buddha Dharma is given for usage in the world. And when we use it properly, the world will change.